March 17th, 2011. Time is 9:02 in the morning. Today we have two bills which we hopefully can move very quickly. House Bill 28 regarding the issuance of temporary licenses for members of the military and their spouses, and Senate Bill 94 regarding the Alaska Flag Song. Hope to move both these bills from committee today and then quickly turn our attention to an overview of the events at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan and what those events could mean for Alaska. First bill we'll take up is House Bill 28, sponsored by Representative Bill Thomas. The bill would allow the spouse of a service member on active duty to obtain a temporary license if they practice in a field regulated by the state's Department of Commerce and meet Alaska's professional standards. We have a CS for this bill. It is version Y and addresses some of the concerns raised during the last hearing. Do I have a motion to adopt version Y for discussion purposes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move that we bring the Senate CS for the CS for House Bill number 28, identified as version / Y, before this committee.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion purposes. And let me recognize that we have a full committee. We have, to my left, Senator Kukesh, Senator Pasvan, Senator Giesel, Senator Meyer. In the audience, we also have Senator Davis. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Schroeder. If I'm objecting to version Y, could you please put yourself on the record and describe for us what the difference is in this version?
For the record, Casey Schroeder Hodge, Staff Representative Thomas. In version Y, the changes appear on page 2, section D. And the changes are in response to some of the discussion at the last hearing regarding the broadness of the term active duty. So we have narrowed that term. And so now a service member can only get an exemption from paying licensing fees if they are in a combat zone, danger pay post, or qualified hazardous duty area. So basically only if they are stationed somewhere overseas where they're going to be in imminent danger.
Any other changes to the bill?
No.
Okay, any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, I will remove my objection to version Y. Is there any further objection to adopting version Y? Okay, seeing none. Are any final questions for Ms. Schroeder? Yes, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment. I just want to thank Representative Thomas for his openness to specifying a bit more in this section. Thanks very much.
Great, thank you. Any other comments? Okay, seeing none, is there a motion to move version Y of House Bill 28 from the committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note?
So moved.
Okay, any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll now take up Senate Bill number 94, sponsored by Senator Davis, which we heard last week. The bill would create a second verse to the Alaska State Song. A similar bill passed the Senate and two House committees last year, but ultimately stalled. Senator Davis, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Please put yourself on the record and feel free to offer any closing comments on Senate Bill 94.
I'm Senator Betty Davis, and I represent District K in Anchorage. And I thank you for bringing this back in a timely manner. The Alaska State Flag Song, the second verse, to be adopted. I just want to remind the committee that last year this bill did pass the Senate. And it has also passed the House on a couple of times, but never both at the same time. I think it's an appropriate time for us to bring it back again. I appreciate the fact that you have looked at this bill and you have considered that it's worthy of moving it along. I do have one concern, and they do have an indeterminate fiscal note on it, which has never had before. And I would like to know from the chair if you would be addressing that, or would I have to bring it up to you?
We are actually planning on addressing that, and I'd like to call my staffer, Michelle, forward. We have some intent language that we've prepared
yes.
on this.
Right.
And maybe you could pull up a chair, Michelle.
I could just give her my seat.
Chairman Wilikowski, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Seidman, and I serve as staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. We did look at the history of the fiscal note for this bill and noted that last year it did pass through four committees with a zero fiscal note. There was an indeterminate fiscal note adopted at the last moment or issued by the Office of the Governor at the last moment. So I did call over to OMB and discussed the indeterminate note with them. They raised two issues. One was that state publications might need to be reprinted with the second verse of the state song. And another, they asked if there would be any need to pay a copyright fee. My understanding after speaking with Senator Davis's staff is that they do, in fact, have a letter stating that there will be no copyright fee. And we did go ahead and draft some intent language for your consideration, specifying that it's the legislature's intent that no additional reprinting occur simply to add the second verse of the state song, that printing of these publications should occur on its normal schedule, and the state song can be included at that point. And that would return us to the zero fiscal note that the bill had last year.
Okay, thank you. And everyone should have in their packets a statement, a legislative intent, if the committee so chooses to adopt that. And I'll read for the record what the statement says. It says, it is the intent of the Alaska State Legislature that no additional funds be spent to reprint state publications simply to include the second verse of the Alaska State song. Instead, reprinting of publications should occur on the schedule it would otherwise have occurred had the second verse not been adopted. We feel that this is an appropriate way to save some funding on this. Is there a motion to adopt this intent?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the legislative intent for Senate Bill 94.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the intent is adopted, which brings us back to the original bill. Are there any final questions for Senator Davis? Okay, seeing none, is there a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note and intent language?
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bill is moved, and we'll take a brief at ease, and we'll start up in just a minute. Our attention to the tragic events taking place in Japan following the massive 9.0 magnitude earthquake that struck the region 11 days ago and the devastating tsunami that followed. Many thousands of Japanese lost their lives as a result of the earthquake and tsunami, and an estimated 500,000 people lost their homes and businesses and are struggling to find sufficient food and warmth to survive. Our hearts go out to the people of Japan. On top of the initial damage wrought by the quake and tsunami, generators at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant were knocked out by flooding that breached the site. The flooding disabled reactor cooling systems and are believed to have caused partial nuclear meltdowns in reactors 1, 2, and 3. In addition, hydrogen explosions destroyed parts of the building housing reactors 1 and 3, and explosion damaged reactor 2's containment, and severe fires broke out at reactor 4. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the situation remains very serious. High levels of contamination have been measured around the plant, and radioactive elements have been found in drinking water, milk, and agricultural products. While we are hopeful the situation has stabilized, it is still very fluid. We scheduled this hearing because many Alaskans have been wondering what, if anything, this disaster could mean to Alaska. We have assembled a group of experts that we hope will shed some light on this question. We know it is highly unlikely that the worst will happen and that we will see levels of radiation that could threaten our health, but we've seen the highly unlikely unfold before and believe local, state, and federal officials must be prepared to respond if things were to go seriously wrong. This is also an opportunity to remind Alaskans of our individual responsibility to prepare for all types of emergencies. Our first speaker is Jonathan Edwards, Director of the Radiation Protection Division with the Environmental Protection Agency. He is online from Washington, D.C. I would like to welcome him and EPA staff who are listening in from D.C. and Region 10. I'd also like to note that we have two experts from Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation with us, Alice Edwards and the Director of the Air Quality Division, and Environmental Health Director Kristen Ryan. Both are available for questions as we proceed. We've asked Director Edwards to address radiation monitoring, trajectory forecasts of air currents that could carry radioactive materials to Alaska, and worst-case scenarios in the unlikely event the situation in Japan deteriorates further. I'd like to welcome Mr. Edwards to the committee. Thank you very much for calling in. And if you could put yourself on the record and talk to us about what's happening right now with the nuclear situation.
Yeah, good morning. This is Jonathan Edwards with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I am the director of EPA's Radiation Protection Division here in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Let me pause just briefly and make sure that you all can hear me properly.
We can. We can hear you just fine.
Okay.
Yes, we can.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. As you've heard from the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, given the type of radionuclides that we see and the situation we see in Japan and the weather conditions and the long transport time, we just do not expect to see any kind of a public health impact to the U.S. But, of course, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has its longstanding fixed airborne radiation monitoring system that's in place. It's been in place for several decades. It continues to look for exactly these kind of things, these kind of events. Let me tell you briefly what we look for and why we look for it. This system was designed several decades ago when the country and other countries were doing atmospheric nuclear weapons testing. It was deployed across the country in order to monitor for fission products that fell out from that, and it's been in service for several years, historically recording these levels and background levels, and was in use during the 1976 Chinese atomic bomb test that happened toward the end of that year. It was in place during the Chernobyl accident, which happened in April 1986, and of course it's in place and operating now in the event of this terrible disaster that's happened at the Japanese nuclear facility. I should say that in 2005, the system was upgraded from that previous system, so there are many enhancements, which I will describe to you in a little bit, that are aiding us in giving us a very good picture of what's in the environment with this system. First, as I mentioned, we're looking for fission products. And, you know, when uranium-235 fissions, intuitively you might think that it splits in half and you get like a nice bell curve distribution. But that isn't the case with uranium-235. It actually splits into a sort of a one-third, two-third part. And so at the top part, that higher part of the distribution, which looks like a double hump of a camel, the top part of that, you get fission products like cesium, iodine, xenon, those kind of things. And if you look down at the lower parts, that one-third part that you're nearing 235 fissions into, you see things like strontium and krypton and that kind of thing. So that's why we look for these products in the environment, the most plentiful fission products along that distribution, and tend to have longer half-lives, and so you want to look for that that impact in the environment. The RadNet system, which is what we call our system, consists of 124 monitors across the U.S., of which the state of Alaska has three permanent sites in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And the stations are designed such that they're sucking air through a high-volume air sampler that's pulling air at roughly around 60 cubic feet per minute through a filter. And the notion of that filter is to draw as many particles out of the air as quickly as you can for a long time to get those trapped on the filter just to see what's out there. And over that filter, we have a specially designed probe that sends the radiation information back via satellite, uplink to a satellite, and then downlink to our National Air and Radiation Environmental Laboratory in Montgomery, Alabama. And it's continuously looking with hourly reports to our database there on that filter to see if it's what kind of gamma radiation we're getting and what kind of beta radiation we're getting. Again, those two types of radiation are great indicators if you've got fission products beginning to collect on your filter. And you can think of gamma radiation as X-ray radiation. We just call it a different name because it comes from the nucleus of the atom versus the electron structure of the atom, which X-rays typically come from. And then beta is just another name for electrons that are kicked off. And again, that's the type of radiation we're looking for from these fission products. There's also alpha radiation, but that takes a little bit of a trickier kind of analysis in the labs to pick up. But again, this frontline monitor that's over the air filter is giving us a very good indication of what's happening near real time at these monitors. The air filters then are pulled off routinely twice a week and sent to our lab in Montgomery for very detailed radiological and chemical analysis to confirm what we're seeing on the real-time monitors. In addition to the three fixed monitors that I mentioned that are already in the state of Alaska, the EPA decided out of an abundance of caution and just to be as prepared as possible in the areas near Japan to send three additional monitors to the state. And you may have heard we've also sent some monitors out to Guam and Hawaii, et cetera. But for the state of Alaska, we sent three. And positioning-wise, we sent them to Dutch Harbor in the Aleutians. We sent one to Nome. And then one was slated for Sitka, but then due to some logistic considerations there, we ended up staging it at an alternate location in Juneau. And again, this was just out of abundance of caution. We didn't expect to see any major upticks or anything, but wanted to make sure we had good, very good coverage for Alaska, given the fact that you are closer than the continental United States to Japan, obviously. The scientists at our National Air and Radiation Environmental Laboratory are very schooled, as you might imagine, in looking at this data, watching the different information that's coming in. You might find it interesting that the gamma radiation monitor that's coming in actually looks at 10 different energy bands that were selected for the kind of energies that come off the gamma radiation of these key radionuclides that I mentioned, cesium, iodine, et cetera. If you think back, just to say a little bit about these fission products, if you think back to either your college or high school chemistry class, if you think of that periodic table of the elements, cesium is in that same column as sodium, And so it behaves chemically like sodium. So when it gets in the environment, it forms salt very easily, and it behaves in your body and in plants and in fish and water just like a salt would. And so it's an important thing to watch. Iodine, as you no doubt know, if you're exposed to it, will be uptaken by your eye, by your thyroid. And so that, of course, is something that we keep an eye on. And then something like strontium is in that same column on the periodic table as calcium, and so it tends to behave chemically like calcium, too, so it'll go to your bones and that kind of thing. So that's sort of a bit of a background on the radionuclides we're looking at and why, and the system there is, again, out there looking for that continuously. I should tell you that once those filters are pulled off the monitors, it takes about 2 to 3 days or so once they're flown back to Montgomery overnight to get all of the detailed analysis off that. Some of the radiochemical analysis, that it takes a couple of days to get the confirmation on it, for example, the strontium analysis. So I just want to make sure you got a sort of a feel for the turnaround on those filters. But again, those filters are just confirmatory or more detailed information that backs up what we're seeing off of those real-time probes. Again, let me assure you that the levels that these monitors are seeing, you can see them yourselves on our website at epa.gov/Japan. 2011, and these levels continue to remain at background. Again, we have folks watching this continuously. We also have the system will automatically alarm should we get even a slight increase from background, and we're looking for levels that stay way, way below any kind of guidance for public precautions or public protective actions that might be necessary. But again, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has said, you know, we just don't expect to see radiation at any kind of harmful levels reaching the U.S. from these plants. I can take questions now. You're like, I hope that overview was helpful for you, and I'm willing to take questions.
Okay, thank you, Director Edwards. Good overview. I'll ask you a few general questions that. Of course, many people in Alaska are concerned with. And could you talk a little bit about the trajectory forecasts of air currents and the likelihood that, under what circumstances might radioactive materials be transported to Alaska?
The expertise in this is in the Department of Energy, and they work closely with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, which is in the Department of Commerce. They're the real experts on the modeling. Of course, our folks are all part of the federal team that works on this. So it's a little bit out of EPA's mission to talk about the specific modeling results. However, as you know from just watching normal weather forecasts and predictions, weather typically takes 2 or so days to hit the Aleutians from that place and about 3 days to hit further into Alaska. But for the detailed weather forecasts and for the modeling projections, it's actually more appropriate for the Department of Energy and NOAA to speak to that. But I do want to tell you this, though, and I've got family up and down the West Coast, too, so I'm being very blunt and straightforward with you here. One of the things about this accident situation that is much different than Chernobyl, which also had a global sort of concerns raised, is the Chernobyl accident happened when the reactor was at full power, exploded the top off of the vessel, and the graphite moderator in there caught on fire, which is a very, very serious, what we call class D fire, and burned for 10 days. So what you had there was a tremendous heat source. Think of a giant campfire or Roman candle or whatever you want to think of, but a huge heat source that drove contaminants high, high up into the atmosphere because of that heat and power. And that's where you get sort of a large, long-range dispersal of contaminants. And you can see, and again, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, if you can line them up, could talk more specifically to the reactor conditions. But you can see how that those circumstances are different than what we're seeing at the Japanese plant.
Okay, Director Edwards, let me ask you, if there were a worst-case scenario, which I know you're not predicting, and there were a large radioactive release in Japan and currents were headed towards Alaska, how much notice would Alaskans have, and what type of responses should Alaskans take in that instance?
Yeah, the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has said, and again, he's basing this on the latest modeling information that we're seeing at the Department of Energy's Atmospheric Release Modeling Center and the best federal team's information on this. As the chairman has said, we just don't expect to see any kind of these levels, even, you know, obviously they're looking at worst-case scenarios, any of the kind of levels reaching harmful levels here in the U.S. And so there really is no need for any kind of precautions. But I will tell you there are plans in place because of the domestic nuclear power plant program here that have established protection action guides at projected doses to the public. And so these are well exercised in areas that have nuclear power plants between the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They are, for example, projected dose triggers for sheltering in place is one particular activity that could be done where you just direct people to stay in while there might be a slight radioactive cloud or release passing over. There's protective action guides for evacuation. There's protective action guides for administration of what we call stable iodine, which are pills you would take that the iodine goes in and saturates your system, saturates your thyroid, so that your thyroid is so full of iodine it can't absorb the radioactive iodine. So there's guidance on that. There's guidance on when you would have to actually relocate portions of the public. And so these are all well thought out and well accepted for several decades, post Three Mile Island when they were developed after that tragic accident. Or rather dramatic accident, and we would take a look at levels. Let me tell you about the Federal Advisory Team. If, for example, levels were to increase in the monitoring network, that information is reviewed for quickly to see if it was some kind of electronic anomaly or some kind of machine malfunction, but once that was quickly assessed, then the data would be looked at quickly if it showed some kind of increase. That data is then passed to what's called the Federal Advisory Team for Environment, Food, and Health. And EPA is one of the standing members on that team, but it's federal experts from EPA, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, from CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, also from the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. And then that team of experts is supplemented as necessary from the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Anyway, they would review any data that would seem to indicate some kind of an increase in concern and quickly assess what kind of projected doses might be out there and if protective actions were needed or precautions were needed. That would be immediately communicated to federal decision makers and state and local officials for their contemplation and quick action if necessary. So that system is in place and has been well exercised, to be perfectly honest with you, based on all the power plant exercises.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Senator Pasvan.
There are Alaskans at this time that are in Japan, whether they're there because they're exchange students or they're vacationing or they're happen to be unfortunately in Japan at the time of this tragedy. What are your thoughts, given the current understanding of the situation, as to the radius of danger in Japan itself?
Yeah, that's very good. As you probably seen, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been working with the Japanese authorities and others to make sure that the correct word has been getting through the State Department to Americans that are in Japan. And so the information the State Department is passing has the highest input, the highest expertise and input from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and others on that. So my thoughts are the advice they're giving, again, carries that kind of credibility with it.
Follow up.
You know, what is the radius of danger if one looks at the three plants that there have been problems at? What is the State Department or others, what are they saying is the radius of danger around those particular plants?
Yeah, the guidance that the NRC and others has put there through the State Department is that all Americans within 50 miles of the plant should evacuate. And so that went out, I think it was Friday, I'm not sure, but it went out a couple of days ago. And that was a little different than the Japanese 20 kilometers. But again, they wanted to make sure that word got to the Americans as quickly as possible. And then the Japanese are also working with our team over there to look at the food products in that area, the milk products and that kind of thing, and make appropriate recommendations there too. But the one you probably heard in the news was that 50-mile evacuation guidance.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Edwards, for your presentation. And thanks for sharing your website, epa.gov/Japan2011. For folks listening who might go to your website, I think they need some context possibly to put what they see there, to frame it. You know, every day we are exposed to radiation, normal radiation from the sun and radioactive elements from the earth. What is the normal yearly exposure that a person receives, and at what level should they be concerned as they look at this monitoring website?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. The National Council for Radiation Protection has recently updated their technical information on the average exposure that the American get, and the average exposure that American gets is about 620 millirem per year. I'll say that again, 620 millirem per year. About half of that is from natural sources like radon and other exposures. And then the other half is from medical exposures, believe it or not. So that 610 is a pretty good number, obviously, that represents average exposure across the country. That varies, of course, depending on whether you've had a lot of medical procedures or not, or where you live, altitude, weather, all those sort of things affect background. But that's the general exposure. The kind of readings that you see off our monitors are extremely low compared to that. Again, it's just background levels. So you know how I mentioned the 620 millirem per year? A typical background level, I'm going to go down several units, is in the range of about, say, 10 to 12 to 14 micro R per hour. So, again, it's several orders of magnitude lower than sort of a typical exposure over the year. And so you can see that background level that our monitors are watching very closely is extremely low. And if we were to pick up, say, some iodine or whatnot from the release, the detectors and the filters are really sensitive and able to pick up those kind of things at very, very low levels. Thousands, even in some cases, millions of times lower than action levels or levels of concern.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
I hope that's helpful.
Okay, Director Edwards, thank you very much for your testimony. We very appreciate you calling in from Washington.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll now move on to the Department of Health and Social Services to address the possible health impacts from low levels of radiation and steps Alaskans can take to protect themselves in the unlikely event that radiation levels were to pose a health threat. With us in Juneau, our state epidemiologist, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, Public Health Preparedness Program Manager Chris Laborde, and I understand the commissioner is with us as well. Welcome, Commissioner. Additional staff are available for questions at the Anchorage LIO, including Carrie Fisher, Deputy Director, Division of Public Health, Dr. Bernie Gilley, Public Health Laboratory Director, Clyde Pierce, Radiological Health Program Chief, and Greg Wilkinson, Public Information Officer. So if we could get someone to come up who's ever doing the presentation from Department of Health and Social Services, put yourself on the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Dr. Joe McLaughlin, and I'm the state epidemiologist and chief of the Alaska Section of Epidemiology.
And for the record, my name is Chris Laborde. I'm the preparedness manager for the.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a great we appreciate the opportunity to be able to debrief you all on the Japanese nuclear crisis and what it means for Alaska, specifically with respect to protecting the public's health. If there are only three key messages that I could impart on you in this short 10-minute lecture, these would be the three that I would pick. Number one, there is no immediate or anticipated threat for harmful levels of radiation to reach Alaska. Number two, based on FDA modeling, Alaska's seafood is unlikely to be affected. And number three, this is an important reminder to all Alaskans that they should assemble a home emergency kit and a family response plan and be prepared for an emergency. I put this slide together just to provide a little framework for what some of the key features of a public health response to a radiation emergency would be. Number one, we at the State Health Department have a duty to inform the public, as well as healthcare providers and partner agencies, about steps that they can take to mitigate a radiation emergency. We also have a duty to protect the public from radiation exposure. This can come through recommendations such as sheltering in place and/or evacuation. We also have a duty to distribute radiation medications such as potassium iodide, and restrict consumption of contaminated food to protect the food supply. We also have a duty to decrease psychological effects of radiation exposure once the exposure has occurred. And finally, perform long-term follow-up for exposed persons. And this involves case identification as well as tracking through the formation of a registry. And we have a duty to make sure that people have access to care. Now, in terms of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services communication response so far, we have responded to numerous media requests, and we've issued several press releases and messages through social media, such as Facebook and Twitter. We have issued an epidemiology bulletin that is written specifically for healthcare providers and provides guidance regarding disaster preparedness and specifically tsunami, earthquake, and radiation emergency preparedness. Our principal messages through all these media outlets have really largely been the same. Number one, there's no anticipated threat to the health of Alaskans based on the modeling that we've seen so far from the federal partners. Number two, Alaskans should not be taking potassium iodide at this time. Number three, we are doing ongoing monitoring of the situation, and we're communicating with local, state, and federal partners. And finally, again, this is an important reminder that all Alaskans should be prepared for an emergency. Well, what can Alaskans do to be prepared for an emergency?
Question from Senator Pastor.
Yes, sir. You know, while Alaska is at the forefront, I guess, in the sense of the wind patterns, but when it comes to the potassium iodine, is there a plan in place that you have to distribute potassium iodine to Alaskans and, if necessary, to get a supply from the lower 48, or if the lower 48 were to need it, do we have a plan to distribute some potassium iodine from here to there?
Senator Paskin, through the chair, I can respond initially, and then I'll hand it over to Chris Laborde if that's okay. Radiation medications are included in the United States Strategic National Stockpile, and these medications include potassium iodide, Prussian blue, and DTPA, all of which can help prevent internal exposure to radiation, as well as antiemetics, neupogen, and antibiotics, which can help alleviate signs and symptoms of radiation sickness once exposure has occurred. Now, the CDC will only deploy the strategic national stockpile if there's a credible threat. And at this point, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, no public health risks are expected in the United States. And, Mr. Chairperson, I'd like to turn this over to Chris Labard, if that's okay.
Through the chair, the state of Alaska does have a plan to distribute. We have what's called the Alaska Strategic National Stockpile Plan that we work this with in conjunction with the Center for Disease Control. This plan is, we have a review of it every year with CDC. The plan is much like what we did with H1N1 in that if there were a credible threat and we received this through the CDC, the shipment would come to us through our warehouse and then we would ship out, repackage and ship out the potassium iodide to the different community health centers. The normal process of transport, the community health centers also have a plan in place for the distribution to their communities. So everyone does have a plan in place.
And I guess just following up on that, is there enough potassium iodide in Alaska right now in case we were to get radiation coming into Alaska? Or would we be relying on getting it from outside of Alaska?
Mr. Chairperson, I'd like to ask Ms. Labard to respond to that, if that's okay.
To the chair, we would get our potassium iodide through the CDC's Strategic National Stockpile.
Okay. Thank you. And just on communications, how do you reach out? How will you get information out to ordinary average Alaskans who are at home, maybe not really paying attention to this situation, should it worsen? What's the communication plan? TV, radio, emergency alerts, phone calls? I mean, how sirens going off? How would Alaskans know that this is a problem?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I would like to defer this question to Carrie Fisher, who's the Deputy Director of the Division of Public Health, and she's available online or on the phone.
Carrie, are you there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, for the record, this is Carrie Fisher, Deputy Director of the Alaska Division of Public Health. I am here, but I would like to defer the question to Greg Wilkinson, our Public Information Officer, who can give you a complete description of our public information.
Okay, Mr. Wilkinson, if you could put yourself on the record and if you have a response, please.
Thank you very much. Greg Wilkinson, Public Information Officer, State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health. Through the chair, yes, we have a extensive plan that has actually been practiced and is reviewed annually, that in a situation like this, we would be notifying the public. Our main way of notifying the public would be through the regular media and through the state websites, also use of new social media such as Twitter and Facebook. But it's my understanding we'd have plenty of time to get this information out as we initiated the rest of the plan. So regular media channels and state websites, Facebook, Twitter.
Okay, and then I heard Director Edwards say that he thought it would take roughly 2 days before radiation would get from Alaska, from Japan to Alaska. Is that your understanding, and is it sort of a two-day plan, or how quickly can you get this information out to Alaskans?
Well, through the chair, I can get information out to Alaskans within a half hour. Getting information out is done all electronically these days, and it happens very quickly. Thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you very much. So what can Alaskans do to be prepared for an emergency? Well, there are a few main things that we recommend. Number one is create a home emergency supply kit, and I've provided a list of some of the supplies that people should have in their kit. We also recommend that folks have a vehicle emergency supply kit, and they develop a family response plan, and then they practice that plan. Now, in terms of monitoring for radiation in Alaska, Alaska's monitoring stations continue to show normal background levels of radiation, as Mr. Edwards already mentioned. We do have five U.S. EPA monitoring stations in Alaska, and I won't go over those again. If levels were to rise substantially, we would measure specific isotopes to determine if steps are needed to protect the public's health. And the data are currently available on the Department of Health and Social Services homepage. And the website is www.hss.state.ak.us. Now, what about the food supply? The U.S. FDA is closely monitoring this situation, and they're performing increased and targeted product sampling at the border. Of note, FDA states that less than 4% of U.S. imported foods come from Japan. Current models indicate that U.S. fishing waters will remain safe. And according to an FDA quote from a recent facts page, they say the great quantity of water in the Pacific Ocean rapidly and effectively dilutes radioactive materials, so fish and seafood are likely to be unaffected. Now, in this slide, I've attempted to provide some comparison data in terms of exposure to radioactive energy. In the left-hand column, you'll see exposures measured in REM, and on the right-hand column, you'll see notes and effects. I'd like to call your attention to the second row first. The second row is a REM exposure of 0.0016, or you can round that up to 0.002. And this is the average amount of radiation that's absorbed per person per day. If you go down to the next one, that's the amount of radiation you'd be exposed to if you had a chest x-ray, 0.04 REM. Now, the average amount of radiation absorbed per person per year is approximately 0.6 REM. And if you were to have a gastrointestinal series done at the doctor's office, that would be 1.4 REMs of exposure. Now, the maximum radiation reported at the main gate of the Fukushima Daiichi power plant was on March 15th, and that was 40 REM. Now, I'll call your attention to the first row. And that is 0.00008. Now, this is the amount of radiation that was reported in Tokyo on that day. Now, let's go down to the last two rows, 5 to 50. Now, this is the first sort of exposure range where you actually start to see signs of radiation sickness. In the fetus, in the embryo, you can see slightly increased risk of malformations, growth and IQ impacts, as well as failure to implant. And then in children and adults, you can start to see changes in blood chemistry, such as a drop in the white blood cell count. When you move down to the 50 to 90 REM exposure range, that's where you actually start to see symptoms of radiation sickness, including nausea, fatigue, vomiting, diarrhea, and you can see hair loss at this range as well. When you get above the 90 REM range, that's where you start to see more serious adverse sequelae. Now, what about availability of radiation medications? Well, as I mentioned earlier, radiation medications are included in the Strategic National Stockpile, and CDC will only deploy if there's a credible threat. And again, no public health risks are expected in the United States. In summary, there is no anticipated threat of harmful radiation exposure to Alaskans at this time. Alaska's seafood is unlikely to be affected, and all Alaskans should be prepared for disasters. And again, more information is available on our Department of Health and Social Services webpage. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. McLaughlin. Very excellent presentation. Questions by the committee? Senator Giesel.
This might be a little off the topic, but when we go through TSA screening, how much exposure is at that time?
Senator Giesel, through the chairperson, I wonder if Dr. Byrne Gilley might be able to answer that question.
Did you hear the question, Dr. Gilley?
Yes, I did. Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Byrne Gilley. I'm the director of the Alaska State Public Health Laboratory, and I'd actually have to defer that to Clyde Pierce, who can actually speak on that technical issue.
Dr. Pierce.
This is Clyde Pierce, Chief of Radiological Health. According to the TSA claims, it's actually lower than background. There was a recent report that in checking some of the equipment, they found that it was 10 times higher than what they've been stating. So that question is still to be defined.
Yes, Dr. McLaughlin.
Mr. Chairperson, I wonder if I could have a follow-up on that. This might be of note with respect to what's happening in the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Custom Border Protection employs radiation detection equipment at both air and sea ports to screen inbound travelers and cargo. In the air environment, the Custom and Border Patrol frontline personnel are equipped with personal radiation detectors that can detect the presence of radiological materials. All airports have more sensitive radiation isotope identification devices to determine both the presence and the type of radiation that's encountered. And travelers who manifest signs of radiation sickness are referred to health authorities and provided appropriate treatment.
Can I just ask you a question? The EPA monitoring stations, is there any particular reason that Juno will be having two different monitoring stations? Is Juno in particular, is it in the weather pattern, if you know?
Mr. Chairperson, I think Clyde Pierce might be the best person to respond to that.
Yes, my understanding talking to EPA is the monitor that has been there for several years doesn't give the full data. For example, if you were to go look at the report now, it doesn't show any beta at all. So they put a temporary monitor there to increase their monitoring capability.
Okay. And are any of you familiar with weather patterns, or have any of you studied weather patterns to see which parts of Alaska might be more likely to be in the jet stream from a radiation release?
Mr. Chairperson, I think Bernie Gilley might be the best person to respond to that one.
Through the chair, sorry to disappoint you. Meteorology is not my strong suit, so I think the best person to answer that would be DEC or NOAA or somebody like that.
Okay. And we have other people coming before us. Okay. Anyone else? Do you have anyone else to testify?
No, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on now to emergency preparedness. And we have the Division of Homeland Security is the foremost agency within state government charged with responding to dangers presented by disasters to the state and its people. We appreciate the presence here today of Deputy Director Michael O'Hare and Deputy Commissioner McHugh Pierre. Okay, let's. My staff has informed me that they may be stuck in another hearing at this point, but. Okay, we have Brian Fisher and Mary Carlson then from DMVA. And if you could put yourselves on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Fisher. I'm the Chief of Operations for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
And I'm Mary Carlson, for the record, Preparedness Program Manager, DMVA, DHS, and EM.
Thank you. And we've asked them to talk about emergency responses to nuclear fallout in the unlikely event they would ever be needed in Alaska, and to give some recommendations about how individuals can prepare.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think our most important message that you've heard both from Mr. Edwards and from Dr. McLaughlin is that we are encouraging all the citizens in Alaska, no matter what the emergency be, to be prepared to have an emergency supply kit, to have an emergent disaster communications plan with your family, and to be prepared to respond to any type of emergency. To go back on some of the things that were already covered, if there was any notification by the federal government about any potential exposure to radiation, we would work hand-in-hand with the Department of Health and Social Services and Environmental Conservation, stand up what we call a unified command between the three departments to make sure our efforts are coordinated. In addition to the public messaging that we would send out, like Mr. Wilkinson said, through normal media channels, our agency, the State Emergency Coordination Center, would stand up and to give you some background, we would handle this situation just like we did the tsunami warning that was in effect a couple of weeks ago. We are extremely proactive in making direct contact to local elected officials and public safety officials at all of the communities that are in the potential path of any kind of threat. So as we are putting the message out to the general public over normal media, we would be in direct contact with all of the community leaders that are in the affected path and would be providing them information just like we are to the public, recommended actions based on the CDC guidance and the Division of Public Health guidance. We would have the National Weather Service specifically as part of this to be able to talk about the current wind patterns and where we think the threat may be coming or going, and give an opportunity for the community leaders to ask all the questions that they need answered. I think it's important to let the committee know and everyone that's hearing, we would not make specific recommendations or issue specific orders to communities on whether to evacuate or not. Just like during the tsunami warning, it's the middle of winter, and local officials with public safety responsibilities are best able to make that call on whether people need to shelter in place or to evacuate. Oftentimes, especially with our climate and the terrain in our coastal communities, it's safer to stay where you are as opposed to evacuating the community or trying to evacuate, particularly in the winter.
Let me just pause for a minute. We have been joined by General Kakis, and do you want to come forward, General, with your team? Welcome to the committee. Appreciate you coming down for this.
Good morning.
Did you want to give any testimony at this time, or were you relying on Mr. Fisher and Ms. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to rely on those folks until I get situated here for a few minutes. Just walking off another committee, and I don't know what's been testified to, and I don't want to sit there and take the time to maybe repeat what you've already heard. So let me sit back, and then if there's any questions, I'll best respond to those.
Okay. Appreciate
my apologies for coming in the middle of it.
No, appreciate you. Appreciate you coming. Let me just ask a question for Mr. Fisher or Ms. Carlson. How would such an order, either to evacuate or to take shelter, be implemented, and what assistance would be provided to Alaskans to implement that order?
Thank you. The decision to issue an order would be made at the local level. The support we would be providing would be technical in nature. When we convened a teleconference like that and provided the information, we would be expecting to hear from the Division of Public Health, from CDC, if we had them on the call, about what the recommendations are. Our website that Dr. McLaughlin mentioned earlier that talks about radiological preparedness talks about the things that citizens should have in place already in case there was an order issued to either shelter in place or to evacuate to a shelter. And just like covered in the testimony earlier, the recommendations are to have an emergency supply kit available. So we would make those we would provide the information to allow local officials to make those recommendations at the time. More than likely, the response to because we're talking about no threat right now, and if there was one, an extremely limited threat would be to shelter in place. We would ask we would recommend that the locals probably issue shelter in place warnings. The way that works in each individual community in the state is variable. Some communities have siren systems where they can turn them on and send an audible message. Obviously, they would be using local media, radio stations, television stations to get that message out. Some communities go door to door. Some communities use their police and fire vehicles and loudspeakers, PA systems, to go to make sure, you know, if this was something that happened in the middle of the night, that people are woken up and they know what they need to do.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Okay, yes, Senator Meyer.
Yes, if I may.
Thank you.
I obviously, you know, all this occurred because of the earthquake itself, Mr. Chairman, and I was just wondering, and this may be an unfair question for General Kakis, but are we involved in any of the assistance in finding survivors of the earthquake? And I think I heard on the news last night where we're starting to evacuate some of the military families that are located over there. And I was wondering if that was just a precautionary thing or if there are some concerns, too, with their health.
Through the chair, Representative Meyer, the National Guard I can speak specifically to. Because of our mixed crews now on our association with the active duty flying such aircraft as the C-17, some of those crews that are in direct support of the efforts in Japan do have National Guardsmen on. This past weekend, I believe I had 7 National Guardsmen that were involved either directly or indirectly on those flights. Some of our aircraft, our refueling wing, is in support and standing ready to support other airborne assets that are, again, working with the effort to address issues with Japan. So as a National Guard element, we are directly working with our military counterparts and in support of the Alaska Command, General Atkins. They've got different contingencies to be prepared to address American citizens leaving Japan. Right now, everything is voluntary. Nobody's been directed out, the last that I am aware of, unless something's changed in the past hours, and I don't think it has. But the efforts are choreographed in conjunction with the Pacific Command, a much broader effort by the United States military to assist wherever it can. And we are part of that team, total integration of the forces. But the Alaska National Guard has no direct responsibility as a National Guard element, just those forces that are attached or working with the active duty that are falling in along with their numbers as they normally would on any of their current missions.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Or General, or Mr. Fisher, or Ms. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, if I could make a statement now, I just wanted to make sure that the main effort that the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs through the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management comes across, that we are not a command and control element. Although I wear a general's uniform, and when we are talking in uniform members, certainly there's a directive, a little bit different personality as a commissioner in charge of this division. We're here for support. And we make sure that we've got oversight of everything everybody's doing and look for holes and gaps and seams and see where we can lend assistance, information, or any other type of advice to make sure that there is an efficient, synchronized, rapid effort in coordinating the great first responders that we have throughout Alaska. Somebody has to have the oversight to see the big picture, and that's what we do through communication, through preparedness, through making sure, again, we synchronize the effort, we offer suggestion and support, and we make sure that everybody, to the best of our ability, is efficient and working as a team. And that's a pretty tall order when it comes to it, but it is not directive, nor, as Mr. Fisher indicated, we don't step in and tell people how to do it. We just suggest and provide resources and listen to their requests and concerns, and we address them. We've got reach-back capability, and we've got the ability to go and get those resources that the various communities may ask for. We facilitate that. So, again, support, not first responders. We sit back and we help. Thank you.
Thank you, General. Appreciate you coming by. Anything you'd like to add?
Mr. Chairman, I've been known never to upstage your boss, so I'm going to let him. Thank you very much.
Just one last question. If in the extremely unlikely event that evacuation were needed, particularly in rural communities, how would this be handled? What are the measures that are in place to deal with that?
Mr. Chairman, actually, when you said the extreme unlikeliness, actually that happens regularly, and we're preparing for such activities right now with Riverwatch. As it's now spring, the snow melt is going to cause some of the rivers to flood, and we start with our education process. We start making sure that people have plans, they've got their kits, they are individually preparing. We're also trying to make sure first responders are preparing with their families. That's a new effort that we have seen as a gap, that a lot of times the first responders in their effort to get right out, who's taking care of those families and people and keeping their mind fully focused on what their effort is. But in the evacuation, we've got different levels. Like Mr. Fisher indicated, sometimes it's best to let that local community leader decide to shelter in place. If not, that local community also has acknowledged that there's schools or there's some other type of shelter available. If weather permits and the request is in, then the National Guard or some other asset that the emergency management folks can coordinate would get in there with aircraft if weather permits, or with boats, or land transportation, depending on the community. So it's an escalating opportunity, and pretty much contingency plans, maybe not specific to a community, but a plan that has applicability to any situation.
Mm-hmm. And do most communities in Alaska that you've dealt with have good plans in place to deal with these sorts of situations?
Any plan is a good plan. Let me tell you there, sir. It's better than no plan. And what we found is communities in Alaska have a plan. And our job is to not go in and critique their plan as much as to always, even the best plan can be improved upon. We make every effort to improve upon those plans. But I'm extremely impressed with the communities. They do have plans in place.
And you actually raised a very good point regarding the chain of command. And I don't know, what is the chain of command? And if there were a radiation release and it were to be coming into Alaska, is it, we've heard from Hess, we've heard from you now. I mean, what is the chain of command there?
The governor's the top of the food chain in Alaska. The governor, he directs all assets that the state has at its ability. The federal government, he may ask and request if they have the resources or if we have expended all of our resources, he may make a request to the President of the United States for assistance from the federal government. And the federal government would roll in with those resources that the governor has asked for. But the chain of command starts with the governor, and that puts every state leader in that chain and responsible for their individual community, their individual section, our individual state.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike O'Hare, Deputy Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. If I could add to what my boss was saying, General was saying, our mantra is we support the local communities. Every event is local, and we support from the smallest event but at the local community level, understanding what the issues are, advising what their needs may or may not be, and providing those resources, those state resources. If the state can't provide those resources, as the general said, we have reached back to other states, to the federal government as well. So it is all coordinated based around supporting local communities. So.
Great, thank you. Final questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you again, General, Mr. O'Hare. Okay,
thank you very much.
Also have a couple other people. Just wanted to close the loop on. We had State Air Quality Director Alice Edwards from the Department of Environmental Conservation. Did you want to just come forward and we'll see if you have any comments for us or if there are any questions for you? Welcome to the committee.
Hi. For the record, I'm Alice Edwards. I'm the director for the Division of Air Quality at the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm not sure that I have that much new information that I can add to what you've already heard today, but if you have some questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
The one thing which I'm not quite sure about is the weather patterns, the meteorological. I don't know if that's something you have any knowledge about.
I don't have a lot of knowledge about how that's being handled through the coordination center. I'm assuming that that's being handled through NOAA or National Weather Service, looking at those models. And I think Mr. Edwards from EPA had noted that Department of Energy and NOAA were the experts in the modeling. So it's more of a global modeling perspective here as far as weather patterns. So that's been feeding in through the federal side, I believe, into the coordination centers.
Okay. Questions? Okay, seeing none. We also have Kristen Ryan on. From Environmental Health on the line. Ms. Ryan, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Did you have any testimony you wanted to give today or anything that prompted you to respond?
Mr. Chairman, no, not at this time. I'm available for questions related to seafood safety, but Dr. McLaughlin covered the basics.
Questions on seafood-related safety? Okay, and just for clarification, Ms. Ryan, you don't see any problems at all to Alaska seafood from this a nuclear release or what's been released so far?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We're monitoring the EPA deposition sites to see if there's any outfall that would impact our seafood species, and at this time there has been no deposition, as you've already heard, at levels that would cause us to be concerned about uptake by our seafood species. And as Dr. McLaughlin mentioned, any deposition over the ocean, not near Alaska, is going to dilute beyond any noticeable impact, any radiation that would fall on fish that happen to be out in the Pacific Ocean. So at this time we are not concerned about the safety of Alaska's seafood products.
Okay, questions for Ms. Ryan? All right, seeing none. Appreciate the time each of the agencies have taken out to be with us today. I want to thank Gavel to Gavel for covering this hearing. Hopefully the reactors at Fukushima will quickly be brought under control and the Japanese can begin the process of rebuilding from this disaster without suffering further harm. Again, our thoughts and prayers are with the Japanese. And with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we're adjourned.